This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Do you have a point of sale system you can trust, or is it a real POS? You need Shopify for retail. From accepting payments to managing inventory, Shopify POS has everything you need to sell in person. Go to shopify.com/system, all lowercase, to take your retail business to the next level today. That's shopify.com/system.
Murderers, fascists, this is suicide television. What the hell is this show going to be? Half the population of Sweden tune in. They want to see what happened.
I have a feeling that some of you maybe hesitantly clicked on this because you thought, all celebrity, reality TV stuff, not my bag. And perhaps you thought this might be a guilty pleasure and look into a bit of Big Brother and Love Island and that stuff. And that is going to happen today, and Survivor and some of the other reality TV series. But this is also, at its essence, one of the most on-the-edge episodes I've done, because we learn about psychology, humanity, the very core of who we are and what happens when we're under the microscope in extreme environments. This is The Truman Show. Jacques Peretti is a really smart and multi-talented journalist and documentary maker, known among other things for his book, Little Bird of Auschwitz, How My Mother Escaped Death and Found Our Family. It details his investigation into his mother's time in Auschwitz in interviews he has with her while she has dementia, so it's a race against time for him to uncover the truth and piece together his family history. So as you can gather, Jacques doesn't go in for the light and fluffy topics. He's written for The Guardian, Wired and The Huffington Post and made documentaries including The Men Who Made Us Fat, The Men Who Made Us Thin and The Men Who Made Us Spend, as well as several documentaries about Michael Jackson. So there's a common thread looking at the way that greater powers manipulate us, and his look at the suicides of reality TV shows is a natural extension. It's what happens when that power is focused on a particular group of people in an artificial environment. He talks about the famous Milgram and Stanford prison experiments and how even they were artificial and faked. We consider the morality of producers who pluck humans from obscurity and flick them into a fickle fishbowl fixed by the eyes of the world. Over 40 suicides have been recorded in reality TV shows with elimination rounds. So that doesn't include, for example, the death of a man who appeared on The Jeremy Kyle Show, the UK's Jeremy Springer, and other kinds of reality TV, which, says Jack, is financially propping up the entire industry. So we'll muse on vigilance, surveillance, morality, and selfishness, what it is to be human. Find Jack easily on Twitter, get his book Little Bird of Auschwitz, and listen to his podcast Edge of Reality, the story TV's too scared to tell. It's on Audible. I just signed up to a free trial to listen to it, so just do that and go from there. Really, really fascinating. I definitely recommend it. Coming up on this podcast are episodes about the murders of the Vatican Church, the belief in flat earth, and how to leave your psychopath. But now, you're on the edge of observable reality with Jacques Peretti. On the off chance you say something interesting, we are recording now. Is it Jack, like with a soft J, or is it a French Jacques?
It's supposed to be Jacques, like the French way, but nobody ever bothers to pronounce it correctly. So it's good. Call me what you like. Jacques's fine. If you can be bothered to pronounce it correctly, that's how it's pronounced. So.
Yeah. How often do you get the chance to do it? I'm going to go with
okay,
Jacques.
Great. Thank you. I appreciate it.
Your podcast is brilliant. I've actually just been listening to it all today, and amazing, really enjoyed it, beautifully put together and everything. What got you interested? It's such an obvious, obvious question. I hate interviewing other journalists because then I'm thinking, oh, he's thinking it's an obvious question. What got you onto it?
It's actually a good question. As I say in the podcast, it was something that I was told about sort of 15 years ago, really. It was when the reality was starting out, and I worked in TV and, you know, I was making documentaries, and it was kind of Chinese whispers, you know, people just started saying there's these really bad things happening on these shows. You know, people have died. No one really knew what the truth was. There was this kind of Chinese whispers as to, you know, was it somebody had killed themselves or had they been killed? And it just sounded really strange. And I thought, as a journalist, I thought in my naivety, this is something that should be told. This is a story that needs investigating. And as soon as I did, of course, the shutters came down. And that's when I thought, wow, this really needs investigating.
Yeah, it's a red rag to a bull, isn't it? To tell a journalist you can't cover that story. But I mean, is there a part of you that is there an activist part of you that maybe wants to sort of see the end? Is that what you'd like, the end of reality shows? Or how do you feel about it? It's complicated, isn't it?
It is. I mean, I love these shows and still do, actually. I still do. I watch them obsessively. I'm tragic like that. I absolutely love these shows. But, you know, I sort of also pompously believe in something called the truth, you know, and it kind of coming out and being told. And I thought, you know, we're in an era now, thank God, as a result of Me Too, you know, victims are being listened to. And I think for a long time, their testimony was just ignored. And it's, you know, what I didn't really understand when I started to look at it was that reality TV is part of a kind of much bigger machine, which is the entertainment industry. And it's as many people say on the podcast, it's the cash cow. It's too big to fail, which is why, you know, documentary is, you know, funded for, it's a kind of almost a loss leader, and underlying it is this machine, this behemoth, which is reality TV. Yeah, I never knew. It's one of those, this thing, this big thing, which is reality TV.
It's funny because obviously reality TV brings to mind like Love Island and stuff like that. But I was just thinking about myself, and I did watch Love Island every now and then, once you get hooked. But you don't necessarily think of ones like Gordon Ramsay, but that's reality TV, isn't it? And it's like he's screaming at people. That's got to, you know, leave some sort of psychological mark, right?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's levels of it, and we concentrated on elimination shows because, the you know, obviously reality involves Kardashians, there's celebrity reality, there's kind of just observing people, following them, like, you know, Jersey Shore or TOWIE, shows like that. But, you know, what we decided to focus on was elimination shows because that's where a lot of the real human damage, you know, the 41 and counting suicides have been on those shows. And we thought it was really interesting because those were the first reality shows as well. And the very first person voted off the very first reality show kills himself, you know. And I thought, well, what the hell happened there? And we investigate that in the first episode. So, you know, just to, you know, not to be down on it, you know, these shows were a remarkable thing. And I think the reason why many people found them so extraordinary, they were a real breath of fresh air when they came along. TV had always been about documentary, if so-called real people were ever allowed on. I mean, back in the 70s, they were vox pops, you know, they'd stop somebody in the street and say, oh, you know, what does the man in the street or the woman in the street think? Let's ask them. So there was always this sort of slightly patronizing, looking down on people, you know, as though somehow they were these, you know, they were only allowed on TV in these very kind of limited, controlled ways. And reality came along and it seemed to offer this opportunity for real people to actually express themselves, and for, you know, the likes of Jay Goody to be on TV. And you thought, well, that's an amazing thing. So, you know, I was suckered in, as every other reality fan was, by how exciting and turbocharged these shows seemed, you know.
I suppose it's at once sort of a great equalizer, but then it's also putting these people in quite a vulnerable position where we're sort of looking at them and pointing at them. You know what I really like about you as a presenter in the podcast is that you don't come down too hard on either side. You're not having to go too much, because there's a danger that it almost would create its own reality show, where now it's the producers we're all pointing fingers at, and they're just humans as well, aren't they?
Yeah, totally. And I think, you know, I think it's up to the listener. It's, you know, it's obviously up to the listener to decide for themselves what they think. All we did was really give the testimony of those who'd been on the shows, those who worked on the shows, and you decide once you listen what you think. I think it's, you know, and also we're in danger of doing basically what the reality shows do, which is to manipulate the emotions of the listener or the viewer so that you're made to think in a certain way. We didn't want to end up doing exactly what they do.
Absolutely. Tell me about the first ever ones, because you talk about two, and I've sort of forgotten which one was first then, because there was the Real World, and then but that didn't, as far as I know, have elimination or anything, and then there was this sort of Swedish Survivor one. So tell me about those.
You know, the Real World, I mean, there's a long debate about, a kind of very boring debate about what constitutes the first reality show. And actually, the truth is that elements of reality have been in documentaries since the 70s. There was a show called The Family. But when The Real World came along, that was on MTV, and this was sort of early 90s. And what it did was it sort of treated people as an experiment. So it was like the idea that really you were creating this laboratory, which was a flat in New York. And the producers had chosen these people to be in this space to see how they would interact. And what I didn't realize was that actually they were not so much the Real World people, but people who subsequently went on to create Survivor, which was the first show, the first proper reality show. They actually used laboratory experiments. They actually used the psychological experiments of these two guys, Milgram and Zimbardo, who'd done these tests in the 70s, basically testing how people would conform when they were told to do ludicrous things. So one of them sort of seemed to be giving the people involved electric shocks. And he wanted to see, like, if an authority figure gave somebody electric shocks, that if an authority figure told these guinea pigs, human guinea pigs, to give electric shocks to someone, would they go through with it? And these tests were, like, really extreme. Zimbardo did this test where he divided a group of people into prisoners and guards and tried to see what would happen if they were allowed to do what they wanted with the prisoners. So these were really extreme experiments, and people in TV started looking at these experiments thinking, wow, they'd make an amazing basis for a TV show. But the irony was that the psychologists had stopped doing these experiments because they thought they were unethical at the very moment where TV people picked them up and think, this would make a great form of TV. So, you know, TV picked up the baton. And this was sort of the background to Survivor. Survivor couldn't get made. And when I spoke to the guys who actually came up with the idea, they were saying, the American broadcasters, they were the first ones they tried it on. They said, no, this is going to be really dangerous. We don't know what's going to happen when we put people in this kind of environment. They were basically scared that someone would die. And so they refused to make the show. So instead, the producers sold the show to Sweden. And in Sweden, the show was called Expedition Robinson. But basically, the rest of the world was watching this pilot series to see how it would go. And if it went well, then they would just roll it out across the world, which is what happened, but not because it went well. So that was kind of why we decided to focus on it, because it was such an important moment. It was the birth of reality TV.
I'm really interested, and we'll get on to whether, or well, why it didn't go well in a second. I'll leave the listeners in some suspense, I suppose. But the Stanford Prison Experiment that you mentioned, I can't remember what the guy's name?
Philip Zimbardo. He was the psychologist. Zimbardo. Yeah.
So that and the Milgram experiment. Before listening to your show, I'd already written those down as questions to ask you about. And then obviously it comes up, and I think, at the first episode. But I was going to ask it about the producers, because the producers are also people who I suppose have been given a role. Well, I suppose that's the prison experiment as well. But even as the electrocute, they're just sort of, it's like you have to, you called it tunnel vision, I think as well. You just have to keep producing things. And I guess, do you lose sight of morality and stuff?
Yeah, I think that's a really key element to this. In a way, it's almost like the biggest element, which is that TV is about fresh ideas. It's about new ideas. I mean, all media is, really. It's about, what can we do next? You know, we've done this. What's the sequel going to be? You know, how's the sequel going to be bigger than the first movie? How's Top Gun 2 going to be bigger than Top Gun 1 or whatever? Jurassic Park. Jurassic Park was a great example that someone uses in the series. They said, you know, we as producers, he said, it was like being scientists in Jurassic Park. You're suddenly given these tools and you're thinking, wow, imagine if we built Jurassic Park. What would that be like? He said, but we didn't. Just like Jurassic Park, we didn't know what we were dealing with. We were messing with the DNA of how shows are made, with no idea of how this would mutate and spiral out of control. And that's such a great analogy, because I think producers, when they saw these experiments that Zimbardo and Milgram had done, they were almost intoxicated with the idea of what was possible on TV. And, you know, one of the producers, David Glover, he puts it brilliantly. He said, we stepped into this world with a trepidatious feeling of like, my goodness, you know, what's going to happen? We don't really know. But at the same time, we're so excited by the TV possibilities here. And so that's why these experiments were, as I say, so intoxicating for TV producers to then take on board, you know.
I suppose the Truman Show would be another good analogy. And if anyone's not watched that yet by now, I mean, they should, because what a great film that is. What did those two experiments, because I think a lot of meaning has been derived from those two big experiments. What did they say to you about humankind? Do you feel pessimistic, or what do you feel about humans?
Well, what's so amazing about those two experiments is that they were both completely fake. So in reality, Zimbardo and Milgram had effectively created a drama. They weren't proper scientists in the sense that they were carrying out an experiment to objectively find out scientifically what would happen. They knew what they wanted from the results. So, for instance, Milgram, he created a film of these experiments and he edited it. He knew what he wanted. Zimbardo would tell the guards how to behave in certain ways, suggest things to them. So it wasn't great science. So the irony was that these so-called scientists were actually perpetrating what reality producers were going to do. They were manipulating their drama. They were creating dramas of their own. So, you know, when you ask Andrew, what do you learn about humanity from them? You don't learn much. Actually, you learn that people are very skilled at manipulating science when they want to. And I thought what we dug up was that actually, ironically, there was an example of people being on a desert island in a scientific situation. You know, in the late 60s, these Tongan schoolboys ran away from home and they were washed up on, there was this big storm and they were basically washed up on a remote island called Atta. And this was almost like a scientist's dream. It was a bunch of kids end up on an island, Lord of the Flies for real. They're there for 18 months. And what did they do when they were there? They didn't fight. They didn't turn into two warring factions. They cooperated. One of them broke his leg. The others nursed him back to health. When they got angry, they imposed their own timeouts so that they could walk away into the jungle, come back. They survived by cooperating and being civil to each other. So that's what I prefer to take away from what humans do when they're in these kind of situations, you know? They're good. They're cool.
Hey, it's Andrew. If you're enjoying Heretics, there's another podcast I want to recommend to you, especially if climate change, global conflicts, and an upcoming election are making you feel like we're on the brink of disaster. What Could Go Right is hosted by Progress Network founder Zachary Carabel and executive director Emma Varvalukas. On What Could Go Right, the hosts sit down with expert guests to discuss the world's most pressing issues without resorting to pessimism or despair that we hear so often. Instead, they look back at how far society has come and look forward at what it will take to achieve an even brighter future. Is progress on the way? They may not have all the answers, but on What Could Go Right, they're asking the key questions. Tune in to hear interviews with upcoming guests like writer Coleman Hughes, CNN host Fareed Zakaria, and economist Alison Schrager. If you're looking for a weekly dose of optimistic ideas from smart people, join them every Wednesday on What Could Go Right, available wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin, or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
I still think like that they don't know, like, my friends, if we got on an island or something, that'd be it, you know. But I'm really pessimistic, you know. I am about in a, I think in a good way, and because I think, like, I think sometimes it's we don't acknowledge that we're selfish, and I think in other, you know, and I think sometimes it might be nice if we do. And I wonder this, I mean, a difficult question. I know you speak of tunnel vision for the producers, but a difficult question to ask to anybody who's really ambitious about their career would be, how much of a negative impact would you be willing to accept on another person who you don't know, so that your job can really flourish, that you'd, so you do amazingly, you know, what would we be willing to accept? And I think I don't really know. I guess we can't know the answer to that, can we?
That's a brilliant question. It really gets to the heart of it, doesn't it? I mean, I think human beings, you know, we're talking about some basic philosophical questions here about what is the nature of the human being. Are we naturally cooperative and collaborative? Are we good, or are we naturally evil? Are we the Hobbesian view, you know, the humanity is brutal and short, you know, that life is about, you know, cutthroat, beat your competitor, survival of the fittest? Is that who we really are? Or are we a naturally, you know, cooperative, you know, are human beings innately good? I don't think we're innately anything. I don't know. I'm not a scientist. I'm not a philosopher. But I think situations and circumstances change. And I think human beings act according to those circumstances, and perhaps also according to who they individually are, perhaps what their inherent nature is. But I think these shows set out to manipulate what we feel human beings are at different moments. So they in a way, they create the Shakespearean panoply of goodies and baddies, villains and, you know, people that we root for. And it's that we want to see, you know, sometimes we want to see good people win, you know, sometimes we want to see bad people get their comeuppance, sometimes we want to see bad people win. It kind of just depends, you know. But I think what these shows do is they supply us with the ready-made cast, and then they manipulate it so that we get that entertainment from that.
No, it's fascinating. It really is. I interviewed, I just remembered as you were talking about the island before, I interviewed one of the survivors for this podcast of the plane crash in Uruguay in the Andes, and he had to eat his friends. But they also, like you say, they got on and they worked together, they collaborated. There were arguments, but it was okay, more or less. Some people stopped talking to each other, but more for the most part, it was okay. But they all said to each other, look, if I die, you can have my body to eat, and that kind of thing. So,
wow, that's amazing. It's kind of what they used to, I think, I mean, I did study philosophy a bit, and actually there's something called log rolling, which is this idea that when you're both on a log, you know, in a Canadian rapids or something, I'm trying to create a little visual picture for you there. And so me and you are on this log, and we're going down the rapids. It's like, what's the best thing? How are we both going to survive this situation? If we fight it out, if I think this log's mine, it's not Andrew's and I want it, I'm going to have a fight with you, but we're probably both going to end up in the water. We're probably both going to end up dead. It's better for both of us to cooperate, to kind of see it through. And so I think maybe just even on a selfish level, people cooperate because they realize pragmatically is the best way of getting through a situation. I don't know, but that's maybe my feeling about it.
There's also game theory though, isn't there? And I think there are certain circumstances. We'd have to have an expert in that because I don't know enough about it.
Me neither.
There's like the prisoner's dilemma. I don't remember what that is.
Yeah, that's right. This is all sounding dimly familiar to me, but I feel terrible, like I should really know these things. But
who remembers a single thing from like classes the day after the exam finishes? It just goes. People listen to this podcast to learn stuff, and the next day it's gone. They've forgotten it.
It's brilliant. It's you're remembering what you need to remember. That's my excuse, but it's definitely not true.
Yeah.
Definitely not true.
But I often ask people. I've started asking friends this, and it's actually a deeply unsettling question. But it's like, you know, similar to what I was asking before. How many people who you don't know would you be willing to accept they just die? They wiped off the face of the planet on the other side of the world. You don't know them, for you to not lose, you know, your legs and arms or something.
I wonder if it's an age thing, you know, because as you get older, you start to think, you know, I'm more chilled out about my career. I'm not, and also I'm a human being, you know, I don't want to see anyone suffer, you know, I'm not that desperate to climb up a greasy pole that I'm not bothered about anyway, in order to see other people die or get humiliated. No, you know, somebody puts it really well. You see, in a way, reality TV, one of the most fascinating episodes for me was the episode where we interview the producers and researchers and runners on these shows, who end up feeling they're the victims as much as the contestants are, you know. And they all say, you know, I did stuff that I feel really bad about now. You know, there was a guy who needed help and I just turned the other way. And just because I was working on the show, I wanted to get promoted. I wanted my bosses to like me. And they feel bad, you know, 10, 15 years later, they still feel really bad as human beings about what they did. And so, you know, they're weighing up this very question that we're talking about. They're saying, I could have got promoted to be the producer. And, you know, there's a kind of... you know, one of them talks about, he says that there was a study done, I think it was at Stanford or something. He said it was a study done into people who climbed up the corporate ladder, that they were sort of corporate sociopaths, you know, that at some level, maybe you need to have that kind of pathology to be able to get to the top. You know, there's the kind of, you know, it's that whole, you know, who is the psychopath test type stuff, you know, who's going to pass it and who isn't. And, you know, a lot of sort of CEOs have a lot more in common with serial killers than you might imagine. You know, it's kind of that, it's that vibe, you know.
It's really interesting you mentioned the psychopath test, because John Ronson, I remember talking about, he had what you're saying about youth. He had this big rivalry with Louis Theroux back in the day. And now they're both like, what was that about? Because you're a bit older and a bit in your 20s, especially. I think there's so much pressure on you to succeed, because it's like, what are you if you're not this huge success? And I guess as you get older, maybe you have family, maybe you have other things going on in your life. And you're like, well.
So you'll love this. So me and John, I know both of them, and John did, me and him did the psychopath test at the Maudsley that they give to serial killers. We did it as part of the publicity for when his book came out. We thought we'd do it.
No way.
Yeah. It was amazing. So basically, you're putting out, I mean, we've got a moment for this, haven't we? I'll tell you, because it is kind of extraordinary.
Yeah.
So they've got, so at the Maudsley, they have this guy, and he, you know, he's interviewed all, you know, his job, he's a psychiatrist. His job is to interview serial killers and determine to what degree they are genuine psychopaths as opposed to just opportunistic killers or whatever it might be. And so me and John did the test. And basically what they have is they take you into a room. They have a screen there. John's sitting on one side of the screen. I was sitting on the other side of the screen. And what they do is they then show you a series of images. They wire you up. So they're wiring you up for your heart rate, your level of, how can I put this, your level of arousal in terms of the images you're about to see, if you know what I mean. And then they show you images. So it starts off, you know, like a cat, a kitten, then they show you a plane crash, then they show you some pornography, then they show you another plane crash, something else. These images flashing up, yeah. And then they have a graph that basically determines your results. So they did this to me and John, and then at the end of it, they go, the guy comes into the room and he said, "God, really interesting results." So he said, "John, you showed kind of a fairly normal human response, which was, you know, you sort of went up and down. It was sort of going like this." I mean, he was freaking out even before the thing started. So his thing was going like this. And then he said, Jack, you know, yours is really interesting. It's kind of like you just flatlined through the whole thing. It's like as though nothing particularly excited you or amazed you." And he said, "That is kind of almost like latent sociopathy." He said, "On one level, you could be a potential serial killer. But," he said, "on another level, you could just be a journalist." He said, "You could have seen a lot of stuff and be not that bothered about it." Which shows you how, in a way, even those things are quite unreliable as a kind of baseline for... But it was an amazing experience. So, yeah.
What, how did they do the arousal? Do they have to put like a string on your...
No, so they can measure how excited you are without having to stick anything on your genitalia. They can work out that, but you know, that arousal is, you know, they said with serial killers and so on, it can be, you know, as you say, sexual, so...
Yeah, I'd panic about that because there's that thing, isn't there? But you're on the way to school and the cars, you know, when you were a teenager, the cars sort of moving up and down, and it's always or in the middle of a lesson about like Oxbow Lakes. It just, you know, so what if it's at the moment they're showing me awful things of like dead cats and stuff? Now, I wouldn't let them do it to me.
Exactly. You're freaking out. You're thinking, if I'm going to be aroused at the wrong moment, they're going to take this the wrong way. And this is that's kind of interesting in terms of, as you say, what does it really say, you know? Wow, we've travelled a long way from reality TV, but yeah, no, it's just, but you know, these types of persons, it's funny because, you know, we spoke to a guy who was actually a professor of criminology and psychopathy, and he said that he'd studied reality shows, and he said that, you know, basically people who apply for these shows divide fairly much into, in terms of women, it's kind of like, women get to kind of quarter life crisis, maybe about 25, 26, and they're thinking, "I'm bored with my life. I might be quite successful, but I just want to try something new." So a bunch of them are just doing it because they want to do something new. A bunch are doing it because they're genuinely looking for love. And a bunch are doing it because of maybe another third, because they want to just push the brand of like they've got a media profile, social media profile. So it's a fairly cynical, if you like, career move. So he said they divide into that. But the men... quite a high degree of them are narcissists, or they show the line for narcissists, which is they get easily angry, they want to be the center of attention, they take slights personally, they just make great television. And so you've got this combustible sort of pot already that, you know, you're throwing all these people into, and obviously it's manipulated in order to create drama. So on a show like Married at First Sight, they will look at the profile of, and this is really dark, which I didn't realize, is that they will look at the profile of women who give you know, confidential medical information to a psychologist. They'll say, "I have abuse in my history, you know, da di da," and then they will find men who have been abusive to women, and they will cast them on the same show because they are looking for that drama.
Oh my God. That shouldn't
happen. Yeah.
Yeah. Legal protocols against that kind of, but I don't even know how that would look, a law against such a specifically strange thing.
So, you know, for instance, Natasha, who was one of our interviewees, who was on Married at First Sight in Australia, she says, you know, "I didn't even trust," she said, "even when things went wrong on the show, I couldn't go back to the psychologist because, in my opinion," she says, "she breached her, you know, her client confidentiality, as a medical professional. She felt that she couldn't trust her because of that." And I think a lot of psychologists feel compromised on these shows. You know, the ones who, especially early in the early days, you know, we talked to Gladina McMahon, who was on Big Brother, and she said, you know, there was a moment where it went from observing people, from these shows being about observing human beings, to manipulating and looking for a certain type of personality type. And she said at that moment, it's like we felt like we were becoming these complicit. in the shows. We were no longer there for the contestants. We were there for the producers to produce entertainment. And a lot of medical professionals felt very unhappy with that. And so we'll walk away, you know. But it's that area is really interesting to me, that element of it.
The playing gods element starts to play. I even remember it in my own lifetime because I watched the first few Big Brothers, which were probably a little bit less invasive, and the people seemed sort of more just quite, almost dull, but it was exciting because it was relatively new. And then the people got sort of more and more, ostentatious or different and strange and maybe psychologically vulnerable.
So they did some audience research, Channel 4 did, and actually all most networks who show reality TV did is nothing special to Channel 4. And they found something really amazing. They found that the audience want to see the next turn of the wheel. They want, after these shows started happening, audiences started behaving like producers. They were like, this is rubbish, you know. Why aren't they doing, you know, something more extreme? Why aren't they throwing them off a cliff, you know? What's going on here? And so I think channels felt, it was almost as though everyone was in this together, ratcheting up the wheel, making it more extreme. And it was after that that Channel 4 made this explicit decision. They said, Big Brother is turning nasty. I think it was Series 4 or Series 5. They basically used that phrase. They said, we're going to make it nasty for the contestants. We're going to start manipulating this thing. And so it went, as you say, from this gentle, observational, quite sweet show where you were like looking at people chatting, you know, about their lives, to suddenly like, you bitch, I'm going to kill you. You bastard, I'm going to do this to you. You know, that whole ramping up of it came because they felt they needed to do that.
It's insane. And like there was an idea a friend of yours had for something called The Net, which is almost sort of the opposite of what's happening with the suicides and stuff. And I thought that was an amazing idea, but I mean, almost impossible to make. But
certainly impossible to make, yeah. So he is great. Sort of TV genius, really. David Glover, his name is. And he was there right at the beginning. He kind of did a show called The Tourist Trap, which was before Big Brother or anything. And it got noticed by all these people who were developing reality shows. And he was sort of doing what they wanted to do. He was putting cameras, fixed cameras in a controlled setting and then observing people. In his case, it was these tourists. And it got him onto the radar of these shows. And he was offered the job of producer on Big Brother. He turned it down because he'd heard about this death on an early show. He didn't really know the details, but he just felt uncomfortable. And at that same time, he was working at Channel 4, where ideas were becoming ever more extreme. And there were these crazy ideas. There was a show called Fat Front Door, which was basically, we're going to build a house around someone obese, and then they're going to have to lose weight in order to get out the house, and then they win the money. These shows that were kind of sort of awful, the kind of an awful idea, but you can imagine people watching it. And he came up with this idea called The Net because he'd seen The Bridge, which was this feature doc about people jumping off the Golden Gate Bridge. And he thought it was unethical that the producer had not intervened. In truth, actually, they had intervened in some cases. David didn't know that. But it was interesting, the ethical position that the people who made that documentary were in. And anyway, David felt that there was a chance to make a show that would be both kind of amazing and groundbreaking, but also positive. So his idea was to put a net under a well-known suicide spot and to essentially catch people. And they would then, the show would then try to prove to them that life was worth living. That was essentially the idea. I mean, it's kind of like insane on lots of levels, and it breaks lots of things that are probably, but on another level it was a kind of, I suppose in a way psychologically it was almost like David was thinking, I'm speaking for him, he's not here, but I know him well enough to think he was thinking, these shows are kind of dark and wrong, you know, and maybe there's a way to do something positive with this type of format. You know, it's kind of like It's a Wonderful Life. If you think about it, it's like that film, It's a Wonderful Life, the moment on the bridge when the angel comes and says to the guy, you don't have to do this. You know, life is amazing. And as you find out, suicide, there are no suicidal people. There's no such thing. There's just moments that we all go through as human human beings. They're a moment that passes. There are, as one psychologist put it really well to me, there are contributing factors, and they add up. They can add up to something or they don't. And it's as random as that, you know. And so, you know, anyway, that was David's idea. It's kind of interesting.
What an idea. I would watch that. And you're completely right. I mean, for all the, and I know why people say, oh, but it has so many moral and ethical issues. But at the end of the day, I mean, if the worst thing that can happen is someone commits suicide, well, they're going to do that anyway, and you're stopping them. And as you say, it is an opportunistic thing, suicide, isn't it? I remember I was reading Malcolm Gladwell writing about that. He writes all about the statistics around when people are stopped from doing it in a particular time and place, they often don't go back and do it again. It's about the place or the moment more than it is about what they necessarily want to do.
100%. And it's all about, if you look on, I mean, without being too morbid, but you know, it's like you have to appeal to human beings in that moment. I mean, I was down in, you know, a place where people do, it's a very picturesque spot, overlooking the sea, and it was also a place where people do sadly commit suicide. And there was a sign up and it said, think about your family. How are they going to feel? And it's interesting because that taps into some psychology that was done at Glasgow University into what motivates human behavior. You know, when they were trying to stop people from smoking or doing something like that, they found that there's no good appealing to people's altruism or even to themselves, even to their own health, because they're too far gone. Say you're addicted to smoking. What they said is, how are your kids going to feel when you're no longer here? How are they going to feel? How are your parents going to feel? And somehow that cuts through. Do you know what I mean? It cuts through to people. And it's sort of like, it's almost like finding that thing. Anyway, it's interesting.
It really is. And it shows how involved reality TV and reality TV concepts are in our psychology. Why Sweden? And you touch on this in the podcast. Why Sweden for the first one, in particular with their mindsets? And then also go on and tell me what happened with that Survivor-esque series.
Yeah, so it was an amazing moment. So basically, there was a new controller of the state channel. She'd become this new exec, and she was told to come in and shake things up. So in a way, the Swedish TV network was prepared for a new idea, in a way that in America, these execs are very risk adverse. They're quite conservative in their decision making. They weren't prepared to take the risk, but she was. And the guy who sold the show to her, his name's Gary Carter, is this amazing kind of character of TV. Amazing. He sold all sorts of shows like Pop Idol, and it's a big player. He said, you know, Sweden's a really interesting place. He says, you know, it has this sort of, on the surface, this flatness, this conformity, this democratic, progressive vibe. But he said, when you scratch the surface, and he said, when you get a few Swedes drunk, and he goes, that's not very hard to do. But he goes, when you get a few Swedes drunk, they basically show their sort of ruthless, entrepreneurial, cutthroat side. So it's almost as though this society, on the one level, it's this one thing, but underneath it's something completely different. And if you expose that on a TV show, you're going to find something really interesting. And so Sweden was in a way perfect for the birth of reality TV, you know. And so what they did was they launched this show. Well, they cast, shall I say, first they cast this show, and they're looking for quote unquote a diverse cast. And what they mean by that is a kind of cross section of Swedish society. So you've got successful business persons, then you've got this guy who is, you've got this Sikh air steward, brilliant guy who we interview, Marcus, who's on it. You get a housewife, you know, the usual kind of array, and one of the contestants is this guy called Sanisa Savija. He's a Bosnian refugee, so he hasn't been in Sweden very long. He goes on the show because he's a really quiet guy. He wants to start his own business, and he thinks in his naivety, he thinks it'd be a good opportunity for Swedish society to see, you know, a refugee making it in Swedish society and being kind of like a very upstanding citizen. So he goes on this show in good faith, thinking it'll be a good experience. And he tells his wife subsequently, he's the first person voted off. He doesn't really know why he's voted off. And actually, when you talk to the contestants, as we do in the podcast, they didn't really want to vote him off. They just said, this is the game. You know, someone's got to be voted off first. They said he's just quiet. You know, he's quiet. He doesn't do much. He's a nice bloke, you know. So he gets voted off. He quietly walks away. But then in the period of time between him being voted off, he flies home back to Sweden. And in the period of time between him flying home and the show is going to air, it starts sort of festering, I think, for him, this idea that he's been voted off. He becomes fearful about how he's going to be portrayed, how he's going to be edited. He says to his wife, you know, I'm worried that they're going to edit out all the good bits and make me look like this bad person. And he starts worrying about what this is going to mean for him and what it's going to mean for other refugees, actually, who have come to Sweden. And what we were talking about is contributing factors build up for him. He didn't have any history of mental health issues, nothing like that. And this is a month or two before the show's due to air, he takes his life, his own life. And, you know, the fear that the US networks had, we're not going to do this show because someone could die on one of these shows, turns out to be realized, this fear, with the very first person voted off. And the networks now have a decision, which is, are they going to junk this whole thing? I mean, a tragedy has taken place. Show hasn't even been shown yet. But, you know, the cynical out there amongst you might think, this is also a really good opportunity because the tabloid press in Sweden are onto this thing. They start calling the Swedish network, you know, murderers, fascists. They say, this is suicide television. What the hell is this show going to be that's about to start? It starts generating massive publicity. So when they decide, they think, okay, we're going to go ahead and we're going to broadcast this show. Half the population of Sweden tune in to watch it because they want to see what happened. And so the show becomes this massive success. Probably not in any small part to what happened to Sunisa. And then, of course, the show is commissioned in America, goes on, is renamed Survivor, goes on to become this machine. But, you know, the human damage is there at the very start. And it's kind of, you know, it's one of the reasons why it takes off. So kind of really, yeah, really interesting.
I think. Really sad. I mean, Sunisa, as far as we know, had no suicidal thoughts before appearing on this, I imagine.
No, I balk at, you know, drawing any crude causal links because, as we've said, you know, suicide is massively complex. You know, you should really have a professional talk. You know, I'm not a professional, but I've talked to a lot of professionals in making this series. And you know, a lot of people who go into reality TV, some of them have mental health issues, which is maybe the reason why they might have applied. Lots don't. And lots of those who've taken their own lives didn't appear to have anything. So, you know, how you connected with the show. You know, what I think is that sometimes vulnerable people are taken, they're on the edge. There's a series is called Edge of Reality. They're on the edge. And in a funny way, not in a funny, in an awful way, they go onto these shows and these shows kind of push them over the edge. So, you know, they add contributing factors. And what we say in the conclusion of our series is that as responsible filmmakers, producers, they've got a duty to the people who appear on these shows to minimize what those contributing factors should be, not maximize them, push them over the edge in the way that they do. And that was sort of our conclusion, really.
I mean, are we all responsible because we're watching and we're probably more likely to watch it the more on the edge they are? I mean, I know Love Island famously sort of the last week is seen as boring. People turn off because everybody's all coupled up. There's no more arguing and stuff. So they're in a bit of a bind, the producers, I suppose. They want to make it as exciting as possible. So people watch it.
I think it's really complex as to, you know, it gets to the heart of what do we find entertaining as human beings? What do we find entertaining? I think we find conflict entertaining, but we also find, you know, uplifting, aspirational things. One of the most successful things on YouTube is basically teenagers opening boxes, right? That is like the biggest thing, is like opening a box and seeing a present. And it's just, you know, if you want to talk about reality TV, you know, the frontier has now moved on to social media. You know, in a way, reality TV is quite old fashioned because it's not doing that thing that's now going on YouTube, you know, with YouTube stars and so on. But, you know, I think the challenge, and I'd put it out there for program makers, is bust out of that box, you know, that you've been in for the last 15 years. Don't make the same show that you've been making, but just try and ramp up and make it more extreme. Do something different. Do something wildly different, because I think human beings, we want every kind of entertainment. And there's no reason why reality TV does also do that. It also does show people very sweet moments. It shows people being cooperative. It shows people in all sorts of different situations. And I think there's something just about the very cynical way that the wheel is ratcheted. You know, there is another way to make TV. It doesn't have to be like that. And I think lots of other shows have demonstrated that. I mean, there are some great shows, you know, like shows like Drag Race, Queer Eye, you know, lots of shows, Little People, which was, you know, about dwarfs. And, you know, it's actually, that looked like a really exploitative show. You would think, oh my God, like the worst kind of thing. It's fantastic because the people on it are superb and there's very little reference. There's no humiliating them. They're just getting on with their lives. And, you know, Queer Eye shows a complete, you know, there are lots of ways in which reality TV shows all kinds of, it's a window on Alaskan trawler men, ice truckers, God knows what. You know, every conceivable kind of community can be represented and has been. And so I'm not down on reality as a genre at all. I think it's an amazing way of showing us other people living their lives, you know. But I just think there's something particular about the elimination kind that can do things to human beings.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
And the way people are manipulated, I suppose, as well, to not be, the whole point of reality is that you're seeing their real lives. You talk about those ice trucker people, they are just being followed, living their lives, and it's an extreme kind of life that's really interesting to us. Whereas I guess, you know, Love Island is not how these people really are in those weeks that they're there. Jeremy Kyle, well, it was another, that's of the 40 suicides you talk about, I mean, that wouldn't even count because that's not an elimination thing, is it, Jeremy Kyle?
Yeah, no, it isn't. And it's interesting. I mean, the Kyle, you know, Kyle is a very particular, you know, it was a Jerry Springer style talk show where you had it always sailed very close to the edge because of the nature of the people it had on and the way that, and actually, ironically, as a lot of people in TV would say, it had a duty of care, which was quite, in some ways, quite robust because of what they'd been dealing with for so long. But, you know, that guy, Steve Diamond, who took his own life, you know, he failed a lie detector test. It was wrong. He didn't, you know, he said in his suicide note that he hadn't cheated, and the show humiliated him on the show. And so that's why. And they took Kyle off because I think to some degree, and this is my own opinion, I don't really know. I'm not a ITV executive, but I think to some degree a lot of people in TV felt very they felt dirty about that show. You know, that show was so horrible, unrelentingly horrible in the way that it portrayed people and working class people. You know, there was something very particular about the way it humiliated a socioeconomic group who are already finding it tough in life without having to be further humiliated on TV. So there was something doubly awful about it, but I think they weren't too bothered about losing that show. You know, it was a daytime show and they didn't like it anyway, I don't think. And Love Island, by comparison, is a cash cow. It's a massive show. It's sold all over the world. You know, the deaths on that show, you know, there was no way they were going to axe that show. And so they didn't. And, you know, those things happened at the same time. But It was complex, very, very complex. And, you know, one of the people who took her life as a result of the Jeremy Kyle thing was one of the producers, Natasha Redican. And, you know, it was tragic. She couldn't get work after that show was... And the people who worked on that show felt deeply upset about what had happened. They'd lost their jobs, but they'd also been part of a trauma, kind of collective trauma. So horrible for everyone involved, you know?
Yeah, it's so easy to judge, isn't it? And, you know, what tends to happen is, you know, if you know someone who's just finished university or whatever it might be, and then you get offered a job on any show, you know, you just want a job. Everyone's desperate for jobs. You're told when you're 21, 22 years old that you're not going to get one. So as soon as you got one, and I had that to an extent. I got a job at The Sun, which is a newspaper for, you know, Americans. It's a tabloids newspaper, and it's really morally, well, I suppose, repugnant, isn't it? And my job... apart from writing articles and stuff at night, I was working at night. I had to upload the page 3 model, which was a model who had her breasts out, to an iPad, the iPad version, so you could twist her around. And from the start, I said, well, should we be doing this at The Sun? And I did push, and they have stopped doing it. Not that I had enough impact. I was just a young, you know, no one listened to me. But it was just a job. I needed the job when I was 21. And if someone had committed suicide because of something I'd done, I think you're right in saying that, you know, these people who work on these shows a lot of the time are victims themselves. They sort of just get caught up in it.
I think it's an... I mean, you know, a lot of these people who we investigate and talk about in our podcast, they're people I know, people I've worked with, they're friends of mine. You know, there's people... They're good people. They're not bad people. You know, they don't... The last thing they would want to think is that what they do... you know, causes damage. But it's almost, it's quite interesting that the reason, if you go back to what we were talking about at the beginning, the Milgram-Zimbardo experiments, so why did they happen to begin with, do you think? Do you know what the basis of why they actually wanted to do those experiments was? So the background was the Eichmann trial. Basically Eichmann, who had been caught by Mossad, a Nazi, had been put on trial. Yeah, had been caught in Argentina, taken on trial, put on trial in Israel. And psychology became fascinated with the idea of, can good people do evil? Can you make good people do something? Can you tell them to just follow orders? In Eichmann's famous phrase, I was just following orders. You saw him in the court. He was like the most boring clerk, bank manager guy. He didn't look, he didn't have horns. He didn't look like a devil. He didn't look like an evil person. And, you know, in that famous Hannah Arendt article about, book about the Eichmann trial, she coins the phrase the banality of evil. And she says that evil isn't this. It doesn't come at you with fangs. It's banal. You know, it's just happens. The administration of terror is what Eichmann was part of. And I mean, I'm not saying that reality TV is the same, but there's something going on that happens in any, not just TV, but in any organization where there's somehow a kind of mobilization of evil, that somehow it just happens as part of the administrative process, that there isn't one person, there isn't a bogeyman, there isn't some nasty person that a channel making us do these things. It just happens as part of a process. And isn't it fascinating that the whole root of reality TV that came through Zimbardo, that came through Milgram, was itself based on trying to understand Eichmann and the banality of evil, that good people can do bad.
A lot of listeners are going to love that, because a lot of these episodes, probably most of them nowadays, are on sort of cults and extreme ideologies and people who've gone too far one way or the other. And just, yeah, I think those are two of the main lessons. One of them is that it is often that, you know, the banality of evil. And the other one is that really intelligent people can still fall for, you know, whether it be a cult or an ideology into producing a TV series that has some really horrible and unsavory results, and you just go along with it day by day, and then before you know it, you've been part of something that's, well, in a sense, committed atrocities. Obviously, you know, as you say, not the same level as the Nazis or anything like that, but some of the stuff is, you know,
human motivation, and you know what motivates us and what makes us, you know, it's a really interesting area. I listened to the QAnon podcast that Gabriel Gatehouse did. I thought it was interesting. You know, they had a guy on who was fascinating, talking about the birth of QAnon. And he said that we live in a world now where, he said, you know, news has gone, truth has gone, objectivity has gone. No one believes any of those things anymore. They just believe the narrative they want to believe. And he said it's a bit like we all live in a kind of multiplex cinema where when we want to consume a bit of news or understand something, instead of the one screen which we're all watching in the old days, we go into our own different screen that we want to watch. So we go into cinema one or cinema two. And if you're liberals, you'll all go into cinema one. And if you're QAnon followers, you'll go into cinema two. And you watch the movie and it's got this, every screen is showing the same characters and kind of the same plot, but it's been written in a completely different way in each cinema. And it said, that's the kind of world we live in. We live in this world of multiple narratives. And, you know, in a way, you know, in a way, reality TV was sort of ahead of the time. You know, it was kind of, you know, again, being down on it, you know, all documentary is a form of manipulation. You choose what you watch, you know, you choose which edit to use, you choose which cutaway to use. You're manipulating the audience. You know, I'm manipulating the audience a bit with my podcast. And that's kind of my next one is going to be about that, the nature of what storytelling is and how you can manipulate people. And it's about that. It's kind of using the true crime space to kind of understand how those shows are made and how we are complicit as program makers, but also as the audience. It really plays with that. I won't give too much away, but I'll come back and discuss that. You know, and I think, you know, the first documentaries ever made, you know, Robert Flaherty, like Man of Arran in the 40s, right? He basically takes a bunch of Irish fishermen. This is supposed to be like upheld as the great piece of documentary filmmaking, right? He basically casts all the fishermen because they look photogenic. He invents the families. He shows them fishing for basking sharks, which didn't even had stopped 40 years earlier. Iwo Jima, the capture of Iwo Jima, right? The famous flag where it's planted, you know, when the Japanese finally surrender. That photograph was staged. You know, they put the soldiers in the right position so it looked heroic. It had actually, you know, every moment that we regard as a sort of news, you know, as sacred, as an objective moment, has been manipulated or staged or in some way controlled, you know. So I think, you know, it sort of gets to the heart of what is truth. What is the truth that we want to see? And, you know, I think reality does that. And in some ways, reality is more honest because it just says there isn't a truth. There's just our manipulation of of the footage, you know. There's something deeply honest about that, in a way.
In my documentary about exorcism for the BBC, I made this this nutter exorcist, right? And at the end of the film, he like locks me in a room and I thought he was going to kill me. It was out in the middle of nowhere in Argentina.
Wow.
At midnight. And we hadn't sold the documentary to the BBC yet. It was just me and my friend, my own David. I was thinking that you had a David. I've got a David. My friend David Hayes, the director. And because I'd sort of suggested that he was sleeping with the women he exorcised, because he was. And he went berserk, and I thought he was going to kill us. And we ended up getting out. We had to climb over loads of like people. But I haven't mentioned it was a big mass he was doing with like thousands of people there. So they're all frothing at the mouth, falling over each other. And we had to like escape and get out. And we got out and we got to like a taxi. And then David said to me, oh, you know what? I had the cap on the camera as you were leaving.
Oh, man.
So I was like, well, we're not going back in there because he's going to kill us. He was then on the stage like shouting like, the devil has left the house, the devil, if he, you know. So I said, we're not going back. And Dave, you know how directors are. He was just like, no, we have to. We can't end without you leaving the thing. So we had this big sort of argument back and forward because I was like, mate, we're getting out, because I was shaking. And he made me go back in. So we had to like go around the corridor hoping the exorcist wouldn't see us, climbing over bodies again. And then he films me leaving. And again, it's what you said, the manipulation, because obviously people would think that was just me leaving. I'm looking all scared again, like, oh God, this argument's just happened. The argument was half an hour ago, but it's part of it.
Did he spot you? Did the guy spot you?
No, because he was like, it's almost like we're walking along a corridor and then there are these open sort of doors from the corridor to the bit where he's doing his mass on stage. Yeah. And he's screaming over and over, "The devil has been here tonight!" And he's screaming about the Falklands, because we're English and he's in Argentina. So he's going, you know, they took our islands, they took this. And we're going, oh my God. And we're sort of creeping over people. And some of the clergy sort of saw us and were like, please don't dob us in. And just about got out of there by the skin of our teeth. But
oh, brilliant. That fake spontaneity, yeah, that we have to all do. That's I know.
Oh, yeah, the noddies. Yeah. Do you know the noddies?
Oh, yeah. And it's exactly as you. I used to do these documentaries for the Beeb. I did a thing called The Men Who Made Us Fat, which was all about about the food industry. And what was amazing was I had to interview this woman who ran, she was a representative for Coca-Cola. And I'd interviewed her about 3 or 4 times for different films. And she was always wheeled out as the kind of, you know, the spokesperson. And I would always get worked up. But the thing was, and I would have to say, you know, you've done this, you've done that, look what you did here. And she would say, yes, but you've got to understand that it's, you know, blah, blah, blah. And this sort of happened 3 or 4 times. So by the 4th time I interviewed her, we kind of got on quite well. It was a sort of awful thing where we'd sit down and you'd have a chat beforehand and you'd say, you know, how are you? And she'd say, and then she knew I had kids and she'd say, how are your kids? And I thought, oh God, this is awful. It's like she's being really nice. And I've got to like, and it would literally be like roll, turn over and I'd say, so I put it to you, madam, you know. And she'd be like, oh, like, and then it would end. It'd be nothing personal. It's like, oh, you know, your kids, you know, I hope they're well and, oh, you know, and all this. It's kind of, you know, it's the game, isn't it? It's the awful game that is played. And, yeah, I can remember I did, this is by the by, but I remember my first job was a researcher in news. And I filmed, it was like a thing about an oil spill. And they had this guy from the oil company coming on. And I just thought, you evil bastard, you know, look what you've done. I was like 21 thinking, God, this is terrible. And then we had someone on from an eco, you know, it was like, not Greenpeace, but someone like that, to kind of do the other side. And they were in the studio and he was saying, it's just disgusting what you've done here. And the oil guy goes, yeah, well, you know. And then afterwards, they were in the green room, the hospitality room, having a drink. And I could see them chatting. And the guy from the oil company says to the eco guy, goes, that was really good, you know. You did really, I thought you were really fired up, you know. And then he said, you know, we could really do with someone like that at the oil company, just to kind of, you know, when we have events like this, you know, accidents, you know. And, you know, the guy took his card. And I thought that was a really, for me, that was a really instructive moment in terms of understanding how it works, you know. Not bad, yeah.
Was the card made of plastic?
Recycled people from somewhere. Man. Yeah,
that, I think that's a lesson we all sort of go through, isn't it? Particularly as journalists, you have to. And I for me, it was the crazy baby lady, who's this woman who throws like plastic fetuses at women trying to get abortions. Again, it was in Latin America, and I was trying to copy. I'd obviously grown up watching Louis Theroux, so I was trying to sort of do that, like go on the school run with her and like hang out with her. And I just loved her, and I was a bit very pro-choice. And I look back and I regret it because I was a bit maybe self-righteous because I was a bit younger, you know. So I was really putting a lot of stuff to her, and we actually fell out in the end, which was such a shame because I loved her, because she was like, could be an aunt or a grandma, you know. And everyone listening now as an aunt or a grandma or a grandpa or a cousin who has views very different to theirs, she thinks we're killing babies, like, you know. So
yeah, I know it's something. See, there's something about people and they have genuine sincere beliefs, and TV people or media people come in with their craven, nasty, hollow-eyed cynicism, where they're just, we're really all the same in that we're about the story, and like, we want the best bit of sync, we want the most extreme opinion to be held. And sort of, and we talk about this in the podcast a lot, actually, because a lot of the producers, they need to befriend, you know. Obviously you have to befriend, and you have this relationship that might last 6 months or a year or however long the show is on for. And it's a one-way thing, because the contestants or participants, they believe that the producer is their friend. They think, you've been nice to me, you know, you call me at the night, you see how I am. And then suddenly it's just like, bang, the guillotine comes down. The end of the show, you're off. You're on to your next victim, shall I say, your next contestant. And these poor people are like, wow, I thought you were my friend. I always thought there'd be some amazing show to be made where you basically get all the contestants who've been dropped to just endlessly harass and follow the people who first persuaded them to be on the show and say, no, I'm going to be in your life now. You know, you were in my life for 6 months. I'm going to be in your life and see how you like it.
I mean, that's a great idea. Where can people find, because it's on Audible, isn't it? Is that where they can find the podcast?
Yeah, so it's on Audible. There's a paywall, but you can find ways of, I don't know, listening to it. I think it's on Audible, and it's called Edge of Reality, and please do listen. I think it's kind of it's surprised people. I think it's surprised people, so take a listen, see what you think.
I think it's brilliant, and I can say it because you'll get in trouble, but yeah, go to audible.co.uk and then just get a free trial, because that's what I did, and then cancel it after you've listened to the podcast. So or keep listening to it if you like all the other Audible stuff, but none of it's as good as Jacques' podcast. That's Edge of Reality, the story TV's too scared to tell. Really, really good. Thank you for being on this Edge.
Oh, pleasure. It's a pleasure, Andrew. Absolutely loved it. And I'll be back. I'm going to force you. I'll be like one of those contestants. I'm going to force myself back onto your show.
Thank you, Jacques, for gracing the stage of the On the Edge with Andrew Gold podcast. What a relief and pleasure it is when a guest is so willing and so able to venture beyond the topic at hand and into the murky realms of philosophy. I had a really great chat, really, really enjoyable. Make sure to listen to the full series, Edge of Reality, the story TV's Too Scared to Tell, on Audible. Just get a free trial and go from there. That's what I did. Coming up on this podcast, as I said at the beginning, are episodes about the murders of the Vatican Church, the belief in flat earth, and how to leave your psychopath. That's all for now. I'll see you next time.
Step into the world of power, loyalty, and luck.
I'm going to make him an offer he can't refuse.
With family, cannolis, and spins mean everything.
Now, you want to get mixed up in the family business.
Introducing The Godfather at ChumbaCasino.com. Test your luck in the shadowy world of The Godfather slot.
Someday, I will call upon you to do a service for me.
Play The Godfather now at ChumbaCasino.com.
Welcome to the family.
VGW Group. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.